Yeah, that's very cool. Jim, welcome to the podcast. As we were just discussing a little bit before we start recording, you and I had most of our conversations in 2020 when there was a big inflection point in the world. And now here we are. How are you coming out on the other side of the pandemic and all things madness, globally speaking?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on, Carl. Maybe let me preface by saying I was excited to talk with you because you are, in my opinion, one of the most authentic and mindful thinkers out there. And so I really enjoy how you ask probing questions, you know, in these episodes. And so I'm excited to kind of get, you know, we called it the meat of the episode. I'm excited to get into the meat with you on this. But in 2020, nobody had ever seen anything remotely like that. And I think what I really enjoyed chatting with you about was, okay, we know that we're in this incredibly uncertain period of time. We can't change that. And I think both you and I agreed it was going to be a while before we were in any sort of certainty period. And so we kind of just said, well, how do you figure out what's still interesting and inspiring and beneficial? And to your credit, you just started talking to people. And you brought people together, and I enjoyed a number of those sessions that, you know, that you put together with a bunch of different people. And to me, what it kind of helped me do is just go, okay, well, this is a grounding moment. Every couple of weeks, I'll jump on and chat with Carl, and, you know, we'll kind of see where we are. And for me specifically, I was viewing it as, you know, we were seeing connected fitness going bananas, which made sense because everybody was at home. But I remember having conversations with you and with some other people. I go, this is not gonna stay this way. There's no way that this is gonna remain this way forever. And so for those who don't know, I mean, I'm an investor primarily. And so I was saying, I don't think this is gonna last. And one of the realities of being an investor is when valuations are running away from you, it's very difficult to be in the space, but you need to be in the space for when those moments of collapse happens. And so one of the things I did in 2020 was I left OPEX and I struck it off on my own, and I started to slowly make investments because I thought that the field was going to, let's just say, get worse. And so that took a while to happen, but it was sort of just through those conversations with me and you and a bunch of other people that helped me crystallize not a certain view of the future, but what I thought the future was going to bring, which was incredibly helpful. So, you know, number one, I appreciate the conversations.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Jim, talk to me about the following. So if the pandemic was a little chaotic, and I tend to say that chaos is self-organizing, how has the let's talk about just specifically the fitness industry right now. How has the fitness industry reorganized itself? Is it connected fitness? Is it personal training? Is it group classes? Is it brick and mortar? Is it online? Is it everything? What are we looking at right now? What's the landscape?
The landscape is, we are still siloed in types of fitness. So there is definitely still buckets of fitness that different types of consumers like a lot. And so certain people have found a pure love of Peloton. Other people have just run back into brick and mortar gyms because they just missed the camaraderie of it all. What we are definitely seeing is an incredibly innovative period of time, but we're still very early in those innovations directly benefiting the customer or the end consumer, right? So there's a lot of intelligence, but the intelligence isn't quite organized simply enough to just go, oh, I can close my ring on my Apple Watch. I like that. And so there's a lot of AI-based suggestion tools that are a little too complicated, but getting close. The equipment hardware, you know, has gotten much better and more intelligent over the past 3 years. And it's become more efficient, you know, so you look at companies like Eleiko putting cable stacks in racks and, you know, so you're seeing a lot more efficient tools. There are a lot more software solutions for coaches out there. And so those have, you know, erupted. You know, Dan, you know, from Push Press is an example of a company who is certainly innovating there. And we are seeing the consumer's mindset shift a lot. So there is a lot more based on wellness, longevity, and certainly strength has been a huge trender over the last year and a half. And I think strength, longevity, wellness is going to trend for years because people have recognized that they can be consistent with that, and being consistent with that feels really good.
Mm. I'm going to make an announcement now, which I haven't shared, is I've gone back into the fitness industry, just like dipping my toes and doing personal training or one-on-one training. Personal training is a funny term because I don't think it's fully personalized as it requires a little bit more than just showing up and running somebody through a workout. But I am focused on the longevity piece, on aging and what that means, and feeling good. So I like that you say that. And I have that sense that this is part of the focus that is going to rise even more as the years go on. And I think especially you and me coming from most of our fitness like focus has been around functional fitness and CrossFit, where the competitive nature of things seems to be the most marketable, but the impact that is related to longevity is the one that has the highest value, in my opinion. Maybe I'm wrong, and depends on how you value.
Well, I'll say this, Carl, we're putting money behind longevity and strength being a real, real important thing for people. So we're looking at it from a brick and mortar standpoint. We're looking at it from a software standpoint. And so just take that for what it's worth. But, you know, we're putting dollars behind that thesis.
Okay. So most of the people that listen here are people who are either fitness professionals with a knack for creativity, are athletes and now becoming teachers or coaches, and they are slowly becoming a business of one. So they are entrepreneurs, but doing it completely alone, which I just have stolen the term solopreneurs, but do have the intention of scaling their business to a point where they feel like they are safe enough to make the next move. And this is now financially through their development in their craft and all the other aspects that bring security to an individual. If we were to just think about the business of one, the person who is operating on their own, how do you, from your perspective, value them, think about them, and how would you advise them with having very little information on how to create a progression for themselves that can lead to positive outcomes, be it financial results, etc.
Yeah. Let me preface by saying each business type is a very different view, in my opinion, but some of the principles underlying it would be you need to be very aware of where you actually are. So a business of one is entirely different than a business of 100. And every action that you do needs to benefit that business of one. And so there's a lot of companies and softwares and programs and systems that are beautiful for a business of 100. And they might be terrible for a business of one. And so my first question that I ask an entrepreneur, whether it's, let's just say business of one, do you know where you are and how are you optimizing for that system? Because I'm a huge believer that you need to optimize for where you are if you intend to go to a place beyond that. And so if you can't make a business, a product, a service go in a business of one, then I don't think that you should try to duplicate it. I don't think you should try to scale it, because you're just going to find more and more roadblocks that your inefficiencies in a business of one will actually probably break you in a business of five. So that is a huge component part. The second thing that I really ask them is, what exactly is your product market fit? And in almost every case with a business of one, they're not sure. And that's okay, but it's really important to figure it out, Because if you can understand what you are doing that's so valuable, and you can show the results of that value, you know, to your customer base, that allows you to both grow revenue ultimately, which, you know, in a business of one goes to your pocket typically, or it allows you to scale up because you are clear on who you serve and perhaps more importantly, who you don't serve. And so, Carl, I've heard you say this. A friend of mine, Greg Head, is a very, very good marketer, and he's got this scaling point methodology. And he talks a lot about it is all about getting so sharp with your value proposition and the delivery of your product that everybody who comes around your product just knows, oh, yeah, yeah, that's Carl. That's what he does. He doesn't do this. He does this. And so in the business of one, I think it's incredibly important to spend time not just crafting, but testing and pressure testing that product, that service, that value proposition so that you can go, that's what I do. That exact thing is what I do, because you can then go to a particular audience and say, you want that? I'm really good at that. It's not this, it's that. And you can actually then ask yourself, is there a scalable framework with which you can build on top of it? And then maybe the third part, there's plenty of granular things in the middle. The third part is you need to be very clear if you ever want to be more than a business of one. And it is a trade-off question, if anything else. It doesn't mean better things to be a business of five. It's just a different thing. You know, in theory, you can make more money as a business of five, but it's not guaranteed. And it's not guaranteed that you actually like the lifestyle with which you have to live as a business of five. And so, you know, you can kind of hear the themes underlying it. It's awareness, and it's a very clear sense of who you are and who you are not that I think needs to go into place in the business of one to either be very successful and or grow into a business of multiple to numerous people.
Yeah, great point. So two things came about for me. One was specializing. I want to talk about that. But before we talk about that, I want to talk about this idea of becoming a business of five. I think a lot of people listening are maybe thinking, oh, if I become a business of five, if I go from a business of one to a business of five, it means that immediately, if we were to look at it as a hierarchy, I would be at the top and I would be leading this thing. But that doesn't necessarily have to be true. You can become a business of five where you now scale yourself and your business, but you don't have to become necessarily the person who's operating the business. You can simply do what you do best within the business. Does that resonate with you? Is that a conversation that you've had before with people who are maybe thinking about scaling?
Yeah, it's particularly, I've started working with a number of influencers in the fitness space, and that is incredibly common that we have that sort of a conversation. And, you know, I'm maybe oversimplifying and overbucketing things together here, so forgive me, but oftentimes there is a theme of, I don't really want to be this term CEO. I really kind of want to be the creative. I want to be artistic, but I think I have to be the CEO, or I think it's more prestigious to be the CEO. And so I kind of go do that. And then 6 or 12 or 18 months later, I'm feeling burned out. I'm not feeling as creative. Revenue hasn't moved. So I'm now just paying more expenses out to be a larger business. I think it's important to identify who you really are and put yourself correctly, and I'll explain correctly in a second, into the role that best serves both you and the business. Let me define correctly. Correctly means you are always going to have to be the leader in some capacity. If it's your business, your name, your brand, et cetera, you have to lead that vision out into the world, in my opinion. But a lot of people in the business of one don't understand what they are really bad at, right? And so they then try to scale up. The CEO, if you will, is the most expensive person that they could get. And so they don't do that, right? They go get a part-time social media person, which oftentimes dilutes their message, because, you know, it's not them saying it anymore, but they're doing it based off of financial constraints. And so I'm not suggesting you go pay $500,000 to bring in a CEO, but I am saying you need to ask yourself, where you need support to grow the business if you want to grow the business. And oftentimes I see this kind of flipped where people are sort of hiring in to take off some of the challenge of content or delivery of product. And then that actually waters down how good the product is. So they're just paying more in expenses to have a less good product.
Yeah, that is a great point. I want to dive into that, but before we get there, because this is itching here for me, this idea of specializing or being very specific about your value proposition, how does one arrive at that? What have you seen works best for people for identifying what they should specialize in?
Yeah, let me try to say this extremely simplistically and then give a little bit more behind it. Ultimately, the value proposition is what, when you deliver it, is your audience ravenous about? And if you can have something that your audience absolutely loves and was willing to buy, that's a great starting point. And you have to kind of start at that starting point. Now, to like the process of finding that, if we want to call it product market fit or value proposition, there could be a number of steps, right? So usually it starts with, if you already have a product, you need to survey your people and ask some questions around, what would you feel like if you could no longer have this product, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so you're trying to gauge how valuable this product is to your audience. And there are some SaaS, so software as a service, there are some SaaS metrics that would suggest the more people care about what happens if they lost the product, the better your product market fit is. And so you can do some measurement around that, but ultimately you kind of have to ask yourself, you know, there's this value prop write up that kind of says, for this particular audience who has this particular problem, we provide this particular solution. Unlike these other solutions, we provide XYZ so that you feel like blank. And that's just one version of it, right? That's just a standard value proposition question. But the way that you get that really, really tight is you test it and you actually ask people how they feel about it. And you ask them how they feel about if they could either have it or if they couldn't have it anymore. And that, again, it's more of a scaling question, you know, in terms of like how wide you do that. But let's say that you were working with people. You mentioned personal training earlier. Let's say that you were a personal trainer working for yourself. What is the particular product that you deliver? So to your point, Carl, you might have somebody that's a specialist in longevity. I would highly argue that you go to the market with a value proposition around personal training for longevity, not personal training, because there's lots of personal trainers. There's far fewer personal trainers for longevity. And what I have found over years and years and years and years and years of doing it, and I cannot tell you how much I have tested this and asked myself, is it actually true? It is actually true. You need to go narrower as opposed to wider. Because if you can get 50 ravenous customers about your product who are willing to pay you whatever it costs, that is more valuable than, you know, double that number willing to pay you 1/5 of what the service costs. And so go narrow, figure out what your audience loves, figure out what you love to deliver, right? And what you are highly capable of delivering, and then prove out that what you believe about your audience and about your service is actually what they think.
That is huge. And I think people listening are probably like, yeah, I hear you, Jim. I just don't know what that is. And do I just keep exploring? Or do I pick one and hope for the best? How do I go about that? What would you suggest if you're trying to mentor somebody or guide them?
Yeah. In 15 seconds, here's my history so that people know that I wasn't on some linear path to where I sit today. I was a collegiate athlete. I majored in finance and economics. Then I went to work for a hedge fund. I then left the hedge fund after 5 years and opened up a CrossFit facility. I then opened another CrossFit facility. Then I sold those. Then I went and did coaching education down in Florida. Then I ended up running the business of coaching education. Then I left again and I started consulting and investing. So it's like, there's nothing linear about that pathway, right? And so the reason why I share that is because the consistent thing that I did throughout all of that was to continue to pursue the things that I was really interested in. And I didn't always make the most amount of money that I could. I didn't always, like, and we're not talking 24/7 inspiration. We're talking overarching inspiration about what I was pursuing. And so I think for anybody listening to this, you have to ask yourself, where will you come from a place of energy, interest, excitement, and curiosity? Because that's what you will run through the brick wall to pursue. And now I am talking commercially, right? So it doesn't always feel great. But if you have something that you just don't appreciate or like or aren't curious about, when it gets really hard, which as any entrepreneur will attest to, it always does at certain points, you need to be willing to run through the brick wall to make it work. And so I would argue that people need to go after the things that are very long-term intriguing to them, and based on the learnings that unlock as they study it or just look into it, therein lies the maybe the bullet points of how you can deliver a product or a service because you have built an expertise or a deep business model understanding of how to deliver something, and your experience and capability of delivering something unique is what will ultimately connect to an audience.
So this is where this idea of owner-operator comes in. And if we're just talking about a business of one, you can't just do the thing that you do. You can't just provide the service. You have to run the business. If the business has dials, and every time you tune the dial or move the dial, it produces movement within the mechanism that is the business. What are the main dials that one should be aware of at the most basic level for a business of one that will guarantee that they at least have a foundation to progress?
It definitely depends on where they are in that business life cycle, but I often come back to dollars per hour, and let's just call it revenue. And so I worked this many hours this month and I made this many dollars. And I know I'm oversimplifying it, but at the end of the day, if you're making $3 an hour and you're not building a highly scalable product, that's not good, right? So if I go build a software company, I might have to spend 2 years before I make any money. But if I succeed in the build of that software, I might be able to onboard new customers at such a fast degree that I can massively overcome that from a time value of money standpoint. For people who are typically delivering either singular products, you know, selling yoga mats or water bottles or, you know, whatever, or they have a service-based business, be it in person or digital, those businesses need to get to cash flow faster, because they are less scalable. And so if you are in a service-based business and you are making $14 an hour, and you're working 40 hours a week, it's like, that's tough because you have expenses and legal fees and other things that you're going to have to pay. That is not enough to either go to a business of five or to have a career of 30 years in this business. So I always say that is an outcome metric. The input metrics are what leads to those dollars per hour. So how are you actually retaining your customers? What are you charging those customers? What are they willing to pay? A lot of people in the services business could charge more and they're just afraid to, right? So there's lots of ways to get to more dollars per hour, but it's important to kind of have that as an overarching business metric. Within the dollars per hour, though, a lot of entrepreneurs ultimately ask the question, should I be working as many hours? And so for me, I'm not the best person to talk about reducing the hours. That's not my shtick. I like working. But a lot of people want to reduce hours. And so they need to learn how to make more dollars per hour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, reducing the hours is very relative. It's reducing the hours and what you focus on.
Yes.
But as long as the focus leads to a conversion, then you're on point. So revenue is number one. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry to cut you off. That's an incredibly important point, because especially in a business of one, there is a huge tendency to accidentally waste time. And it's not because you're trying to waste time. It's because you're not necessarily sure where to put your focus, or you've got to deal with an accountant or a lawyer or a whatever. And you really have never done that before. So you overly spend too much time doing those things. Experience matters here, but I think it's at least relevant to say it is very important to figure out which inputs lead to the outputs, at least as best as you can ascertain. Because if you can understand that, that's where you want to leverage, right? And I go back to the point of you need to find that specific point that you can kind of shoot the gap and put your resources into that particular thing in order to grow that particular thing. That is a huge important key to all of this.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So for example, if you take a personal trainer who is for the most part exchanging their time for money, and if they were to scale, it would maybe be having some kind of online product at the most basic level. It seems like getting to a point where you have an ecosystem of product services is step one for scaling. But
ooh, can I jump in there?
Not everybody knows how to. Yeah, please.
Yeah. I would argue that getting to a suite of products is what's required for scale. I would argue that one unbelievably demanded product is what allows for scale. And then if you can find that, you have a foundation with which you can build expansion revenue on top of for different customer segments of that main product. Let's look at the nth degree example, right? Facebook. What was the product? Well, it was originally social media, and they spent years before they ever monetized that social media. So what was originally just a social media platform put so many eyeballs into it and made those eyeballs so captive that they could basically put whatever advertising model on top of them and just print money. In a services-based business, if you want to have something that is scalable, and we can argue about what the definition of scalable is in a services business, but let's just say if you have something that could scale to many thousands of customers, that at least is closer to the term scale, you still need something that you can say, okay, perfect customer A, I have this service. You literally click this button to start this service, and I know that on a monthly basis, you're going to receive this flywheel of things. I'm highly certain that will happen. You will receive this amount of value. I can see how you progress in that customer life cycle. And if you are still with us in, pick a number, 9 months, I now introduce to you our expansion revenue product because you are now at this point. And that then typically is where a lot of margin comes in. But without that first product, there is no such thing as scale. And I'm emphatic about this because I see way too many businesses of 1 to 20 trying to put too many products out and not actually honing in on the main product that is working. And it's usually because it isn't working well enough.
Yes. Okay. Thank you for steering us here, because this is actually really important. So I guess where my mind was thinking about personal training and thinking, okay, eventually I'm going to run out of hours. So either I reduce the time that I spend with each person, or I start to combine people into cohorts, meaning I start to make it kind of like a group class. And now I'm doing group fitness. And then from group fitness, maybe I get to a point where I can't be there all the time. So now I have to get another person to start to cover for me or to work with me just so we can get more people. I guess there's a progression here. And that means that the product is not necessarily personal training, it's personalized training, maybe, right? So it's not me one-on-one with you, it's me giving you exactly what you need. It's a specific prescription, and that being, it seems to be the product that we need to focus on rather than the craft itself or the practice itself or the role, so to speak, that you play.
Yes.
Am I on the right path here?
Yes. And it might be important to know, I've been doing that digital online coaching, you know, personalized since 2011. I haven't physically coached people in a while, but I've been in companies that have done that for a while. And so I have seen the evolution of personal training to online coaching and all the systems that now support it and all the efficiency tools and workout builders and all that good stuff. What I believe is, there's a lot to think about here. You need to have a product that you can prove that a particular group of people are willing to pay you the right dollars per hour for you to deliver that product. And so if the goal is more total revenue, I think without any argument, we could say yes. If you can coach more people in less time, you could theoretically make more money. What I have found, though, is that individualized training or personalized training is that people ultimately want to work less and make more. And so they ultimately don't deliver as good of a service. So if you can deliver as good of a service, and obviously it's different than in-person personal training, right? But if you can deliver as valuable of a service, of course, I would argue you should go at that particular product if you want to grow revenue. It's just that what used to be great for personalized training, digital coaching, right, is not great anymore because the number of software systems that are pushing the price point down of this are very real. And so in my opinion, the coach now needs to ask themselves, are they a value product, i.e. lower cost, or are they a premium product, more white glove? And you need to be one of those two. The middle does not work anymore. So as long as somebody is very, very specific about where they sit in that realm, it can work really, really well. And I agree with your point that they can make a lot more revenue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you're making a really interesting point here, which is it seems like this divide between premium and value, lower price point, people are getting caught in the gap and just falling through there and just can't manage to rev up revenue.
Really quickly, and specifically, just so that people, I'm not just kind of living in the gray here, specifically what I mean by that is what used to be a highly valued product, which was I deliver a program, you do the program and put it in through True Coach, Coach RX, Train Heroic, whatever, and I do a X number of minute call with you once per month. Like that used to be premium, beyond all premium. It's just not anymore. That is now the middle. And so the question is, what do you do as a coach that is so unique that I cannot get from $150 a month with Future, Copilot, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Which, by the way, those are great companies. But you have to ask yourself, what am I doing that is unique and valuable to that customer? And doing a product or service that is less expensive with the same value is good, right? Like there's so many coaches who are so worried about delivering less. There's nothing wrong with delivering less if you set expectations and meet or exceed those expectations for a price point. But if you're going premium, premium is very different today than it was 3 years ago. Very, very different.
Yeah. Okay. We can define premium and what the characteristics of are of that and what the pros and cons are for something that is maybe requiring tech and something that's going to be at a lower price point. Let's define this. I think this is important, actually. So what characterizes premium versus, what are you calling it?
Value?
The lower value. Yeah, yeah, the lower value one, the lower price.
Yeah. I believe that comes down to typically human touch points and results. Now, results is finicky because a lot of people can get results with a program only, right? So it depends on the customer. But what I believe is happening is that the number of human touch points mixed with the number of things the coach does for the customer creates premium. So think about it from this standpoint. If I, the coach, would do a weekly call with you for the right customer with the right set of goals, right, who has a big problem to solve for, that generally speaking is liked by most online members or clients. Additionally, if I instead of forcing you to do all of your macros and track all of your food, if I ordered food and had it shipped to your front door and you didn't have to do anything, that's white glove, right? It's those types of services. Now, a lot of coaches are probably just, you know, cursing me hearing this right now, but that is what the market's expectation of higher value is, because they can get great programs for $39 a month now. It's not about the program. It's about how you help somebody execute the program and how you help them work through the different component parts of what's getting in their way of executing the program that really, really matters. Same with business coaching, right? Like a lot of people, they have this singular product, and ultimately for many business owners, it doesn't work. Well, it's because every business is a little bit different, right? And so your willingness as a business coach or whatever you want to call this, a mentor, whatever the term, you have to actually help them get results. And that's why I always place results into that, is because usually, because we're human, there's things that get in our way that is quite difficult for AI, in big quotes, to solve for. And so I think the touch points do create a level of premium today.
And it seems like, and this is maybe me being completely naive now, and I'm just kind of shooting from the hip, it seems like premium is something that is more likely to be part of somebody who has a business of one versus the lower cost a product or service seeming to be something that becomes more of a business of many.
I do think that there is truth to that. Usually, as an audience gets larger, the product has to get more specific and, well, specifically broad, if that makes sense, right? Like, you have to build a product that can be broad. And so let's use longevity, right? There could be millions of people who want longevity, and just bear with me, right? Let's add a layer to it. Female longevity. Ooh, okay, that cuts out all the males, right? And female over 45 years old longevity. Ooh, okay, that cuts out more. And so the products that have achieved scale usually start very, very specific. And then as they earn bigger audiences, they just kind of get broader, right? And so I think that a lot of people forget that. They started narrow with a particular audience, but they then built a platform that could serve more people. And again, let's go back to Dan from Push Press, right? It's very, very hard to build a gym management software to serve lots of different types of gyms. That's why you don't see Push Press serving Lifetime Fitness as well as CrossFit, because the needs of those business owners are incredibly different. Now, maybe somewhere 5-10 years down the road, Push Press can have different types of software to serve those, but it never happens that way to start. And so to your point on maybe on the price structure, I would say it is more likely that something that really scales has a lower price point. It's not guaranteed, but it's more likely.
Interesting. Yeah, that's interesting to think about it that way, and that it makes sense. Okay, so let's take now a little bit of this idea of the influencer type personality that maybe you have been engaging with as of late. And I'm thinking about right now, specifically for me, I'm thinking about the world of dance, specifically breakers, break dancers, who are competitive athletes, where their main stream of their revenue stream is showing up and winning competitions. So it's kind of like, I win this competition, I get some money. And then eventually they win enough competitions that they get invited to more, and then that builds a base. And then some company comes in and says, you know what, I want you to be part of our marketing department, and we want to endorse you and put you on a retainer. And then you're going to have a couple of deliverables that are pretty basic, and we'll pay you some money. And then they kind of scale their revenue a little bit. But what I end up seeing is that they get trapped in that. They don't scale themselves.
Yep.
Like, their revenue scales, but their ability to produce more leverage doesn't. What is one thing that you've seen that allows people to not only progress to increasing their revenue, but gain to the point where they can actually position themselves for escape velocity, for that inflection point that leads to greater outcome.
Yeah. Let's call that, for lack of a better term, the influencer game, because ultimately people pay for name and likeness when name and likeness is meaningful, and meaningful is just revenue at the end of the day. Revenue, frankly, for these companies is conversions to people who purchase their product. And the reason why I say that is because these companies are getting far more sophisticated than they were 5 years ago about, is this person actually generating sales for us? And some of the influencers that we work with currently are in this exact space. There are certain brands that when they work with them, people just amazingly buy these products, right? Like, it's wild how aggressively people buy products. And then there's other companies that they work with where it's like, it doesn't matter how much they post or whatever, nobody cares to buy the product. And so, like everything, there is a market that either likes or dislikes a certain marketing tactic. In this case, the influencer is the tactic. And so where the person, the breakdancer in this case, has the most value is if they post about the brand, and that adds impressions, reach, engagement, and sales. That's where the money is, frankly. Like, let's just be blunt. That is where the money is. If you, as the influencer, aren't creating that much value, it's just not going to last that long. And it's an unfortunate thing. But these brands don't just pay because you have an audience. They pay if your audience buys their product. And so they'll give you a shot 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. But then after that, if nothing happens, it's not going to keep going. And I think maybe that's partially what you're describing about can't get to escape velocity or duplication. What I think
you're explaining it really nicely. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, what I think the influencer needs to do, and let me break it into two categories. One, how do they grow their promotional partnerships, right? And so what they get paid to talk about. And then the second part is, are they also building a sustainable business? And so what you'll notice, at least, typically with big influencers, is as they get bigger, they are usually building an owned channel of revenue. And so they have their promotional partnerships, which, you know, could be Nike, Adidas, et cetera, et cetera. And then they have a program, forgive me because I'm not an expert in breakdance, but whatever sort of apparel, like they might sell their own apparel and then not partner with a Nike or Adidas, right? And so usually there is an owned channel and there's a promotional channel. And you don't typically do this with a business of one, so let me be fair. But you then come in, you say, okay, if I can grow my overall follower base, and if I can get that follower base to be captive, and, you know, I'm a big competitive advantages guy, so we could go down a rabbit hole about what that actually mean and what it doesn't mean. But if the audience is captive, meaning they will do, generally speaking, what I ask them to do, then that is monetizable both to the promotional channel as well as to the owned channel. And so I would argue that if you want to grow, I think it's smart if you have a large enough following to grow both of those things. But remember that it is a trade-off in time and expenses to grow both of those things effectively. And usually what I see from the influencer side is they ultimately dilute both of those sides of the business because they aren't fully focused on one or the other.
I love this because one of the things that I've just kind of noticed is that people are just desperate to grow quickly. And for example, now with breaking, going to the Olympics in 2024, there's this window where the market is definitely inflated and the price points are a little higher than I think they should be. And that bubble will most likely burst. But in the process of kind of capturing this moment, people feel like they have to choose, which I think is great because they have to choose either the channel that's owned or the channel that is promoted. Most people who are focusing heavily on just being an athlete are leaning into the promotional channel. Yep. Those who know that they're maybe not going to be as successful as they can be as an athlete are leaning towards the owned channel. And they're not doing this consciously. It's happening organically, which I think is pretty interesting, because I think intuitively they got it right. My curiosity is, if you have an own channel, it feels like you're playing the long game, where you're just like, I'm just going to try to slowly make this product, this channel that I have here, my ability to express myself, as incrementally better as I can over a long span of time. This promotional channel feels more like the opportunity for creating an inflection point, but you can't capture the true value of the inflection point that comes from the promotional channel. Let's say you partner with a Nike or a Reebok or an Adidas or whatever, and all of a sudden you get more eyeballs, you get more movement, you get more exposure, whatever it may be. If you can't capture that that wave, then you kind of wasted your time. Does that resonate when I say this? And how does it land for you? What's coming up?
Yeah, I would be hesitant to say you've missed or wasted it, but it is true. And I think we have to remember that the promotional game is very...
Say you didn't maximize. You didn't maximize your efforts and the opportunity.
Yeah, now my head's wrapped around it. Promotional stuff is all about now. Who's hot now? What message is hot now? What product is hot now? There is incredibly little staying power after that. And look no farther than retired NFL, NBA players. If they're not commentators, if they're not huge social media influencers, you know, ongoingly working at it, they're gone, right? Like they're now selling local car dealership stuff at significantly discounted value to themselves. That's just the way that game works, because if you want a huge international brand like Nike, you need to command a huge international audience, or an international audience of a niche place, right? And so that is all about how hot you are right now. It just is. And so the owned channel, which I don't want to make sound like it's easy to build, it's not easy to build, but it is about, hey, if I build these systems, if I create these marketing campaigns, if I build these channels of sales and learn how to retain my customers and have them rebuy, and your earlier point about expansion revenue, if I do build that, at some point, I can probably have some other people help me to continue to sell that product without me having to be 24/7 in front of the camera. Now, let's be realistic. Influencers often struggle with being in front of the camera all the time. It is definitely not butterflies and rainbows for people as much as some might think. And so what I am seeing in the influencer space right now is I'm seeing people earning less on the promotional side and struggling to build a product. And so this idea of having an audience doesn't matter as much as it used to. The question is, I'm sure I've heard you say this, it's about how good the audience you have is. And so again, that's why the specificity of a product or the specificity of a vision or a mission or a message matters so much. Because if your audience is ravenous about you, your product, your vision, etc., they are much more likely to purchase your products, as opposed to if you just post a whole bunch of random stuff that people don't really have a particular understanding of you about. I've seen people with a million person, you know, Instagram following who can't sell a darn thing. It's because they don't mean anything to an audience. They're just like, oh yeah, you're the person I watch when I'm bored. But there's no message. And so it's like, just look at the marketing life cycle, right? If you can't go from awareness to interest, there is never such a thing as demand, right? And so you have to, like, there's always a marketing pipeline, always, 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 always. And so if you're not building the marketing pipeline to be able to sell products, your influence is merely impressions, which if it's only about impressions, you don't make any money.
And then there's something to be said about just getting exposure. And there are a lot of brands, for example, that are looking at breaking right now, specifically because it's getting some attention through the Olympic platform. So they're investing and putting money into breaking cautiously, but they don't have any expectations of creating a conversion. They just want brand exposure. Yep. So there's something to be said there, and there is value there. The problem is that when you're on the receiving end of being bought, so to speak, or somebody seeming to be investing in you as an individual or as a community, where in reality, it's not about you. It's simply about what the brand wants.
Yeah.
Well, does that resonate with you? Or
yeah, hugely so. Hugely so. And I'm the first one to say, if you can catch a wave, whether you deserve it or not, catch the wave. You know, go for it. But I think it's just important for people to remember that the wave could be the Olympics. And I have a very different example of this, so this might not land perfectly, but you know, I was a hedge fund trader trading commodities in 2008 as the China Olympics, the Beijing Olympics were about to go. And what did I see nonstop was steel being purchased out the wazoo, you know, across the world because China was building infrastructure to host the best ever Olympic Games. Well, what happens after the China Olympic Games happened? The price of steel completely got eviscerated because there was no more demand. Now, I think what you're saying is, can breaking create a platform, a foundation with which it can continue to grow? I think that remains to be seen. And certainly, you know, in a digital world as opposed to steel, right, it is much more likely that a foundation will create further opportunities. So, you know, I would be optimistic, but I don't think that it will continue to just hockey stick up like it's doing right now because the Olympics are a one-time event. It's the first time ever going in. There's a lot of buzz. So what's the term? Newsjack, right? Like you're newsjacking the Olympics right now. Go for it and make sure that you build something while the industry is hot just in case it cools off a little bit afterwards.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm proposing to athletes that I currently advise is, look, focus on being an athlete, try to qualify for the Olympics. Whether you make it to the Olympics or not, use this as the wave that you're trying to catch. Within the regulations, what you can do is you can go to the Olympics, win the Olympics or not win the Olympics, whatever it is, and then right after that, then you release the thing that you've been building up until that point, so which is the channel that you own, whether it's a service or a product or whatever it may be, a piece of software. Anything that you've created. So yes, I'm with you 100% on that. I want to try to shift gears here a little bit and just use some history within CrossFit. I'm curious about this idea of partnership and then we can get into competitive advantages. But partnership, for example, when Reebok came in and became the main, I think they called it sponsor or partner with the CrossFit Games. Why would CrossFit, for example, want to have Reebok as a partner? Was it to produce better equipment, or in this case, footwear and apparel? Was it brand? Was it what do you think it was? And how do you now look back at the last 14 years or whatever it's been, and seeing the evolution of those partnerships? And kind of analyze that in terms of what a stage-by-stage progression looks like. Can we use that as a case study?
Yeah, I don't think I'm the perfect person to describe this because I wasn't on the inside of those partnerships discussions, so I'm merely speculating.
Speculate away.
Yeah, I think that the Reebok partnership was probably primarily done to bring cash into CrossFit so that they could fund a larger games. Now, I'm sure they assumed, and I think that this played out at least to some degree, I think that they would assume that having Reebok attached gave CrossFit more credibility and also opened up far larger channels. And I do think that, you know, there's obviously a bunch of volatility around the relationship over the years, right? But Reebok spending time thinking about and having their employees and all of their audience around the world doing CrossFit certainly brought a significantly larger audience into CrossFit. I don't, though, think that CrossFit probably said day one, let's go partner with Reebok if they don't give us any money. Right. And so Reebok comes in, pays him a bunch of money. For, oh, I don't know what the original deal was, but certainly the second promoted deal was the big deal.
I think it was $150 million for 10 years, but then it added on top of that because they realized that, okay, we're just buying CrossFit Games. We want to get access to everything else. And I think there was additional things added.
Now, I think we can talk about that in a good light, but you also have to talk about CrossFit hasn't really retained a long-term partnership outside of Rogue. And I think that's interesting, right? So like we're beyond Reebok, we're now beyond Noble as far as I know. And the question is why don't these relationships remain? And so there is clearly a value misalignment somewhere, or else those brands would stay on. Now, you could make whatever argument you want about the political leanings of old school CrossFit versus new school CrossFit. You could make the argument, are the games as big as they say they are? You could make the argument that, hey, you don't let us sell into your gyms. So, right, like this conversion thing isn't nearly as big as we want. You could make the argument that if Nike can sell Metcons and they can, you know, have trucks outside of the games with billboards on the trucks, right? Like, why are we paying $150 million for this? And in all honesty, I think they're trying to figure that out. I don't think that they have a great answer yet, though, because as of 2 years ago, they missed the boat, maybe as big as they've ever missed the boat, by trying to put Monster in as a sponsor for the games. And you're like, your audience is viscerally against this, and this makes no sense to us. And so I think that they are still trying to figure out how they have a large dollar value relationship that is aligned with where CrossFit wants to go. But let's go right back to the beginning of our conversation. CrossFit needs to know where they want to go first. I think that CrossFit got turned upside down in 2020, and then they, you know, they 180'd everything about CrossFit in 2020. And that confused everybody just as much as 2020 did. And now they're trying to sort of figure out a pathway forward. And again, I'm not inside of it, but that's what it strikes me as an outsider trying to understand it.
Yeah, exactly. The reason I went that route is because I wanted to get to this idea of partnership being beyond two organizations, but rather the members of each organization beyond those who work for the organization, meaning their customers. So, for example, you were the CEO for OPEX for several years, and I believe that James Fitzgerald wanted to compete in the games but didn't do it the year that Reebok came in, because he was asked to wear Reebok in competition. I think that was one of the reasons he didn't compete in the games. Can you remember that? Do I have that correct?
I honestly don't remember that, Carl. I apologize. I wouldn't be surprised, right? Like, especially if they weren't directly being paid to wear that clothing. But I don't know that for sure, no.
Yeah, I think it was, I guess it was 2010, maybe 2011 was the first year of Reebok. I can't remember if it was 2010 or 2011 now. I think 2010.
Probably 10.
But I believe 10. Okay, so yeah, OPEX wasn't OPEX. It was OPT was still the thing.
Yep. And I didn't get to OPEX until 2014. Interestingly enough, James did compete at the games later on, and he would have been in the Reebok year. But I wouldn't be surprised, right? Like, James is a principled guy like that. And if he got it in his mind that this wasn't the right thing, he definitely would have stayed out.
Yeah. Anyways, if anybody is listening, please forgive us for not having our facts right here and tell us what really happened. But what I'm trying to get to is, a lot of times partnerships or collaborations can actually alienate your base. And when you alienate your base, I think a lot of bad things happen, and especially what ends up happening is that you lose credibility, you stunt your growth. So picking the right people to work with or collaborate with is important. Is the first point of alignment, as you said, being focused on the customer and making sure that your original customer, that which you have been serving and maybe gotten you to this point, should be the primary point of focus when developing a partnership with somebody or a collaboration?
The older I get and the more partnerships I see, the more I think as much of the stakeholder chain as can be aligned must be aligned for a partnership to work. And so to me, the stakeholder chain would be customer, employee, let's call it executives, and then shareholders. And so I think all of those things for a perfect partnership in quotes need to be there if you want something to have the best chance of succeeding. So it's like, hey, if you have employees and customers stoked about something, that's great, unless it costs the company $500 million a year for the privilege, right? And so if you can't commercialize that excitement, a partnership simply can't last forever. But if you can create a commercially viable from a revenue or a profit standpoint, that is really, really interesting. And so usually, and I think what you were suggesting is, if the customer is really fired up about the alignment of two particular brands, that's a great foundation. If the employees, coaches, et cetera, are just as fired up about that, that adds to it. If the then executives can see how this benefits and grows both businesses even better, and then if there's a commercially viable business model, even better. And so, you know, if we look at CrossFit, right, I think probably some of the arguments around CrossFit, and I'm just thinking out loud, would be they tout very specific things around health. And many of those brands are smaller, right? So like, what was a great partnership for a while? And, you know, it was FitAid, now it's O2, right? Like, we're talking about the drinks that tout healthiness, right? Like, those have been pretty good partnerships. Rogue has been a great partnership. I don't know if there's ever been any really bad components of Rogue, but to the public, it looks like it's been rock solid for the entire time. And I would argue it's because CrossFitters like Rogue gear, coaches love having Rogue gear, you know, the executives see where that's going to grow. And of course, there's huge viable business models for Rogue to be building CrossFit and CrossFit to be building Rogue. And so I think if they can continue to build partnerships like that, and of course there are going to be smaller partnerships along the way. I'm going to give a shout out to one of them actually, because I think he's doing an awesome job from what I see. The Haven backpack team, like I just, we're not invested in them. I unfortunately didn't invest in them a while ago. I think what they're doing is really cool, but it's like, that's a great example of a smaller partnership today that could grow into something. And I think CrossFit absolutely should sign up for those types of partnerships. Because they hit those different stakeholders. And if Haven gets a lot larger, it will be a business model that works. But in the meantime, Haven will pay some money for the privilege of being at the games. You know, like that makes sense to me, right? And so I think there always needs to be some early companies that are sort of potentially turning into something, and some larger or very large companies that really do, they can pay the bills, but because they're big enough and they have a product that is universal enough, they can make money because they're attached to the CrossFit brand.
Okay, so now this is interesting, because we've taken people on a little adventure out into the world of growth or scaling to some degree. And I mean, this is something that you would have to go on for 10 years talking about for several hours a day to fully understand. But I want to pull it back now to a small, medium-sized company that is doing really well. How important is it to identify their competitive advantages? This is something that I know you care about a lot. and what are competitive advantages, and how do we identify them?
I am a bit of a stickler for the definitions of competitive advantages, because I hear the term thrown around a lot, and I think it's often misused. So I'm a believer in competitive advantages at the, let's call it the Warren Buffett level, meaning companies that have defensible advantages that are not easily duplicated or not duplicatable. So it's the difference in Coca-Cola having bottlers all over the world, as opposed to a new upstart not having any of that infrastructure built. It's the difference between Apple having an entire ecosystem of products that all work together. So if you leave one of those Apple products, you feel really bad, right? Because it's like, oh, you know, I got this watch and it doesn't connect with anything else. This is ridiculous, you know? And so that's a switching cost example, right? That is a tangible and defensible competitive advantage that Apple has built. So if I'm being a stickler, like a five-person business almost assuredly does not have a tangible, defensible, competitive advantage, but they could be building one. And so I think the key is, what are you building towards? And can you defend in local, in quotes, can you defend your local turf? And as you expand, can you expand on that competitive advantage? And so usually the way that this kind of gets, you know, run down is there's supply competitive advantages and demand competitive advantages, and then like government contracts, right? If you have the contract to build the F-35 fighter pipe, you know, fighter jet, it's like nobody else has that contract. And so that is a defensible advantage that your company has that other companies simply cannot have. And so if you think about what sort of the component parts of that are, and I'm going to be most specific about the ones that I see in the fitness space the most often. Number one is almost always, do you have a captive customer base? And so I'm going to speak to one of the companies that I know really well because I've known him forever. I know you know him too, but Marcus Philly and Functional Bodybuilding. Do they have a defensible, large-scale competitive advantage with a captive customer base? No. But Marcus is such an authentic and empathetic and honest human, and he has put so much of himself out there as an athlete and now a coach, and now, you know, he's got a big program, etc. His audience loves him. Loves him. And that is different than likes him, right? So like when Marcus explores a piece of fitness, his audience goes with him. And so he could get people to do bodybuilding for 12 months and then switch back into something around longevity. And they're like, let's go. And so that is the articulation of a captive customer base, right? Like, what are all the details that got him there? Difficult to explain in a couple of minutes. But he has an audience that really does follow him. And by the way, they really do buy from him too, because he has a product that they trust, and he's built an incredible amount of trust with his audience. So, you know, if you look at it that way, what are some of the other captive customer bases? Nike, it has to come up, right? The way that Nike has built a vision around the individual athlete is unbelievably powerful, unbelievably powerful. People feel something when they buy a Nike product. They know that Nike makes a shoe for $15 overseas, and they don't care. That is a captive customer base, right? So you've got a captive customer base, which if you're building a fitness company, I almost always argue you have to find the broad's the wrong word here, but you have to find the message that resonates so deeply with your audience. And you need to duplicate that message a whole lot so that people know who you are, what you stand for. It feels very repetitive, but that's the way that you build traction, particularly in an online business. The second one that I usually see is you have to create some version of economies of scale. And all that means, just to boil it all down, the larger you get, the better your business has to run. And that is extremely opposite, typically, to the business of five. So you have to build systems and processes that are duplicatable without you around. And that's we could go days on that subject, Carl. I know you can too, but that's a big one. Switching costs.
I'm actually curious. Curious about that. And I would like to touch on it just a little bit, but keep going on your list and then we'll get into it.
I'll go quickly through the rest, right? Switching costs, meaning if you were to get rid of a service or a subscription, or you stop following somebody, does it hurt? Right? Like, there's a lot of things. So for example, imagine if you got rid of Gmail, It's like, what? All my emails from the history of time gone? Like, you can't fathom getting rid of something like that. And so do you have something that if somebody leaves it, it hurts? And this is all behavioral, right? And then, of course, you have, like, there are actual partnership advantages. There are patent, you know, and IP advantages that people can have. There are government-type contracts that people can have. But when you start to mix those things together, the best companies have really built things that other companies simply cannot. So, like, that's the nth degree of a competitive advantage. I do think it's important for companies to be thinking about what they're building towards. Whether they ever get there or not, I'd argue they'd probably be better as long as they are aware of what they're building towards.
Yeah, a lot to unpack there. And as we're slowly running out of time, I do want to touch on this idea of operator. And I think Marcus Philly is such a great example. What are some of the characteristics of a great owner operator like Marcus Philly, for example, that you've seen carry over to other people that you've advised or businesses that you've invested in?
Yeah, they need to be able to get people on board. And so there are lots of different personality types that can get lots of different other personality types to follow them. But without the key, the word that's coming to my mind is je ne sais quoi. I don't know why, but it's like there is a feature about these people where people get magnetized to them. And so that's really, really important, because usually that means that it is less physical work for that person to try to gather people and move in a particular direction. And a lot of this stuff is about how do you reduce the friction to create scale, right? A lot of it's just that there's so much friction that companies can't get to escape velocity. So reducing friction is important. And for the owner operator to build a captive customer base or a following, it needs to kind of just be part of their psyche, if you will. Otherwise, there's a lot of friction for, like, you just have to work too hard. Also, they have to be willing to initially do the things to grow the business and then duplicate that job process, standard operating procedure with somebody else so that they can get back to the thing that, you know, we talked about shooting the gap earlier, so that they can get back to the thing that helps them shoot the gap even more. So if you look at a Marcus company, and anybody who doesn't know him, you know, he owns Functional Bodybuilding, is just a great success story in the business. He almost always comes back to, I need to be exploring fitness. I need to be out there, like, experiencing fitness, because that's where all of my creativity comes from. That's where my coaching comes from. That's where all of my very magnetizing ideas come from. And so usually, you know, and the way that I often work with him, right, is like, cool, you're too far down the operator, you know, pathway right now. Let's pull you back so that you can get recreative. Let's take a breath and then go again. But he's willing to kind of go back and forth between those two areas, because his business and growing his business, it does matter to him. And other people are like, some people might want to grow their businesses bigger, faster. That's fine. But I can tell you, just by knowing Marcus for a long time, like, he's really kind of zoning into, like, this is what I want to have. This is what I want to own. And what is most important to him from the business standpoint, right, is making sure that he's serving his customers. That's not that normal, right? A lot of people aren't ultimately about that. They're about revenue and profits and whatever. Marcus would not sacrifice his customer base for profit. And that's one of the reasons that I was attracted to work with him, etc., right? Like, you strike me as the same type of guy, Carl, and that's why I love chatting with you. You know, so that is hard to duplicate. I would argue Marcus has a semi-defensible local competitive advantage as it relates to that. And actually, one other piece, right? Dan from Push Press, one more time. I would argue their single greatest competitive advantage is their captive customer base, by far. And yes, that sometimes makes them a bit more inefficient. But when you have an audience that will go to war with you, good to go.
Right. right. That is huge. That is huge. Yeah, my brain has gone like this. It's just like branched out to into a million things. To kind of bring this to a gentle close, a slow close. What's the overarching message in that which you're trying to share with people right now, and maybe also funneled into what you're building?
Yeah, I think, and I've made this mistake more than once. I think it's really important to continuously spend the time to get narrower about what you're doing, who you're serving, how it's helping or not that audience, and how you are delivering that product or service in a lower friction way to better serve that audience. And so, like, what am I trying to do? You know, I want to, I consult with people in business and I invest in companies in business. That's it. And we've gone wider in our consulting and we've gone narrower in our consulting. And I can tell you that we are the most successful when we are narrow, because it's very clear. It's like, what do you go to? And my business partner is Jason Crow, right? Like, what do you go to Jim and Jason for? These couple things. They're really good at those. They don't do the other stuff, right? And so not only does that give us a pricing advantage, but it also gives us a much smaller amount of business development time that we have to do. I'm not out there trying to sell our services. People come to us. We take inbound. And so, like, doing a show like this, like, I'm not trying to sell my services. We don't need it because we have a very narrow consulting business, because our business model is primarily based on making good investments. We do consulting because we like helping people in the industry and because we don't charge our investors any fees. So that's our business model, right? So on the investing side, what I have spent many years developing, and I hope one day it's good, right, is what I focus the most on is our decision-making tools for how we make investment decisions. We follow a very particular process with how we go from zero to an investment. And every time we go through that process, I update the tools and I do a little after action and I ask ourselves, like, what's working, what's not working. And then every quarter, we go back to each company that we've invested in and we evaluate, was our decision sensible? And we don't, like, not sensible, but did our expectations meet with what the reality is, so that we can make a better process for making decisions? So my goal is, there's 0% chance that we will succeed with every investment. But if I can improve our probability of making a good investment by a little bit every year in 25 or 30 years, that'll be really meaningful. And for some people, it's like, oh, that doesn't sound like a lot. It's like, maybe it's not, but I know exactly what I'm working on, why I'm working on it, and how to scale, again, in quotes, that thing.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so that leads me to our final questions. My final question, which is, what are some of those questions that you ask yourself to make good decisions in what you invest in? And are there any of those questions that could be transferable to the business of one? Meaning, let's say I'm a podcaster, I'm a business of one, and I'm like, oh man, I want to scale this thing. I want to improve this thing. I'm going to invest in getting somebody to edit. I'm going to invest in equipment. I'm going to invest in whatever it may be that I'm investing in. What are some of the questions that I should be asking myself?
Yeah, we view it this way. View it that each of our sections is like a tab in an Excel booklet or a Google sheet or something like that. So we have a theme for that particular page and we have questions inside of that page. The themes of that page are essentially, we've got a team and a founder page, and we really try to evaluate what we believe about the founder. And one of our biggest, most important questions is, are they a hedgehog? And hedgehog really just means, is this their life's work? Are they willing to go and go and go and figure it out and go and go and go, as opposed to the fox who is in this for a year and then they want to sell out and, you know, onto the next thing. And so there's a lot based on that. So maybe the parallel to your audience would be, are they doing this thing for the right reasons? Yes or no? If they're not doing it for the right reasons, and they need to be aware enough to answer that question honestly and truthfully, then I hope I sniff that out and don't make an investment. I'll just be that blunt about that. Another one that's really important to us is the business model. Most businesses of one don't really understand their business model. So I'll go back to myself for a second. Our business model is we take our cash flows from consulting and we reinvest them into investing into other companies. It's as simple as that. But if I thought that my most important thing was to create a large consulting business, I would build the business differently. And so you got to know what your real flywheel is, and you have to put gas into that flywheel, and you have to constantly tweak and adjust that flywheel, because until you find it, it feels like you're rolling a boulder up a hill. Another one are the competitors. And let's just call this, you need to understand where you are unique and where you aren't unique. There's a lot of places that, you know, businesses of one believe they are unique, and they will actually get to me in a pitch and I'll say, can you tell me how you're different than these 15 competitors that I've seen in the last 6 months come across my desk? And oftentimes, I won't say often, 50-50, I know of more competitors than the founders that are looking for investment capital. That's not good. So you really need to be honest about how unique you are. And the more unique, assuming there's an audience that wants to follow that, all things equal, the better, assuming it's a large enough audience. We have to ask questions about the target market size, because you might be the best person in the world to deliver a service, but if you can only deliver to one person willing to pay you $100 a month, it's just not gonna work. You know, we ask a lot of checklisty type questions, but the last piece that's incredibly, incredibly important to us, two pieces. The financial information is really important, so we got to know that. But for this show, we ask ourselves a lot of bias checking questions, because it's so easy for us to just want a company to work or want something that we believe is impactful to work. And so we have set up, you know, particular questions to try and break our bias so that we get back to as logical of a decision as we possibly can. Admittedly, it doesn't always completely work, but taking a breath, stopping and being like, okay, what are the things that you might be viewing this company through the lens of that if that wasn't the case, you would change your investment philosophy? And I swear, Carl, 2 of 5 companies, I'm like, and you kind of get to that point. You're like, I knew it was happening, but writing it down makes it real. And now I have to kind of change my perception of, you know, maybe if I need to ask some different questions or something like that. So the business of one needs to really know who they are and if they're doing it for the right reasons. They really need to understand their business model and that product market fit that we talked about. They need to understand the unit economics, i.e., if they sell more, is it actually better? And a lot of times it isn't. If you have to add fixed costs, whether it's people or assets, et cetera, to the business. And then they have to ask themselves, where am I unique? And is that true? And then I would argue that they need to have outside people pressure test some of their answers, because they will always be biased.
Jim, what a way to end the podcast. I think that can be your mic drop. That's the playbook. If we had to condense the whole podcast into one thing, I would say it's the last 3 minutes. That
awesome, man.
That was
I'm glad we got three wonderful. Good ones.
No, the whole thing was incredible. I really appreciate it. I feel like I could go for another 10 hours, because there's so many layers and so many ways to skin the cat, so to speak, that I feel excited about our conversation. You really sparked a lot of thinking in me. So thank you. And this last little take home playbook is super, super valuable. So thank you so much. Jim, anything you want the audience to know before we send you?
No. I mean, I'm a LinkedIn guy. I haven't been on Instagram for a while, so come find me on LinkedIn. I'm just Jim Crowell, Crowell. And I always do this, but if anybody wants, I'm just jim@thesagehouse.com if you have any questions.
All right, thanks. My friend. Thank you so much. Don't hang up on me. And I hope to talk to you in a follow-up little podcast.
Thanks, Carl. This was great, man. I enjoyed it.
Appreciate it.